Welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, friends. I am talking to you. It is the morning of Game 7 of the World Series. Like Christmas morning. What could be more exciting? Man, this World Series has been so great. I hope you've been following along my writing at CBS Sports and my TV-isms everywhere and my radio-isms everywhere. It's so lucky. I'm so lucky to be able to do this for a living. I literally cannot believe that I'm going to be in Dodger Stadium tonight, let alone that it's my job to actually be able to report and write about it. It's great. I feel great about this. I'm not sure how it is exactly that people get kind of disenchanted with a job like this. Maybe some people do, but man, I dig it. It's the best. So thanks to all of you who consume the stuff that I write and talk about and all that stuff, which allows me to do this incredible job. And thanks to CBS Sports for being fantastic. Today's podcast is with Joe Davis. So I talked to Joe on Tuesday, so that would have been before Game 6 of the World Series, and we were discussing everything. Joe is the play-by-play man for the Dodgers. He's the guy who replaced Vin Scully. It's quite the honor, and Joe is very insightful and really, really good at his job, an excellent announcer. We ran the gamut here. We talked about kind of his path to the big leagues, and we talked about this World Series, and we talked about different kinds of drama and games that he likes and Joe Buck and all kinds of cool stuff. He's great. I love Joe. And we've been trying to make this podcast happen for a while. We'd go back and forth on Twitter and couldn't quite figure it out. But then we managed to get together and bless him. He came to my hotel. I'm just running around like a chicken with my head cut off. He said, "I'll just come to you." I said, "Great." And so we did it and it was excellent. There was a fire drill in the middle of it too, which you will hear for like 1 second, which is very funny. Anyway. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Joe's terrific. And just so you know, the World Series will, end tonight. And my writing will calm down a little bit after the World Series ends, but I'll still be doing podcasts. You'll still get the podcast every week. And I have a bunch in the can already. Cause I'll be taking a little bit of time off in November just to gain some sanity. But you'll get all those podcasts. They're going to be great. And I've got some others coming up that are really cool, that are on the schedule. Still traveling and doing these in person, and of all the things that I do, I really love the writing and everything like that, but I've said this before, the podcast is it, you know, it not only is a lot of fun to get to know people in that way, but it kind of changes the way that you look at life, and you start talking to friends, and you say, "Oh, what about this?" And you ask these introspective and probing questions that maybe people aren't used to, and then they open up to you, which is cool, and hopefully I'm opening up in the same way. It's neat to be able to be an old dude like me and to get to 43 and be like, "Oh yeah, maybe I'll try life a little differently." And the podcast actually has been part of that, just thinking about interpersonal relationships in a different way. So that's cool. Also, by the way, I want to give a shout out to Beto Duran, who is a great podcaster in his own right. And I appeared on his podcast, Living the Dream, and you can check that out on iTunes or, you know, just follow Beto on Twitter and you can get that too. But it was cool. And he, speaking of opening up, we went deep. I mean, I was talking about family stuff from like when I was 17 years old and all kinds of stuff. A different kind of conversation, I think, that I've ever had with anybody, at least in a public forum. So Beto's great. Support his podcast too, Living the Dream. You can subscribe to that. And that'll do it. So here you go. It is today's episode of the Jonah Carey Podcast. It is with Dodgers play-by-play man and Vin Scully replacement, heir apparent, whatever you want to say, Joe Davis. Enjoy.
Up my neck at the gym today. Like,
we already started recording. Your gym thing has been recorded for posterity. No, it's okay. Joe Davis has injured himself.
Yeah.
And it's a problem. So wait, is your neck going to be a problem during the actual World Series?
Perhaps. Yeah. Yeah.
You need like a tripod or something for your neck as you're watching the game?
So I did this spring too, just being stupid and thinking I'm stronger than I am at the gym, trying to do overhead press. And this spring, I injured my neck doing it. And I did it the morning that my wife and baby and I were going to drive to Arizona. So we had a five-hour drive to Phoenix, trying to sit up in the car with a strained neck, not able to lift my chin. I looked so ridiculous. We had a towel in the back seat that I wrapped around my neck and made, like, into a brace. So if you have a towel, maybe I can use that.
I feel like you need a medical professional.
That could help, too, right? Like seeing a doctor.
That might be the move. By the way, as everybody knows, what do you do with overhead press? The move at the gym, you do the glamour muscles, man. You get in there on the chest, biceps, and you abandon everything else. Everybody knows that. You don't want a holistic routine.
Curls are for the girls is what I was always told. Yeah, here I am just trying to be a little bit bigger than I should be.
There you go. Well, Joe, it's a pleasure to have you here. We've been talking about doing this for a while. And we have a mutual friend in Joe Block, who spoke very kindly of you on the podcast. And I'm always fascinated by the journey of broadcasters. We need to talk at length about the World Series, too. Yeah. So I think what we'll do is we will talk World Series first.
Cool.
If that's okay.
Yeah.
Holy fuck, man. Like, it's, you know, last year was incredible. It was really incredible. Game 7, Cubs-Indians last year. It's probably the best baseball game I've ever been to. Yeah. It was ridiculous. And I have this thing, I have this personal affectation or whatever. Like, when I get really excited, my reaction is to laugh. You know, if something happens, like, I just start, oh my God, and I start laughing. And it does not win you friends in the press box. Because you're not supposed to cheer. I'm not like, yay, Rajay Davis, yay, Cody Bellinger.
You're like, yay, baseball.
Yay, baseball. Yeah. I'm so yay, baseball. And I think that because I'm not a beat writer, I'm not in the long slog for 162 plus playoffs.
Yeah.
Who is this clown, you know, parachuting in and doing this stuff? What is your reaction when something totally insane happens? I mean, are you just, is there a voice modulation cue in your mind that goes up? It's like, oh, Cody Bellinger. Like, how do you got to kind of keep it in check and be an announcer, but you have to express enthusiasm.
Yeah. I think it's something that you work on over time. And that's something that in minor league baseball, I think is the biggest thing that you have a chance to work on. The reps are everything in the business. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why is you get to kind of find where you belong in that spectrum of getting excited. So you can go back and listen to my tapes in Montgomery and find me everywhere from right here on the big plays.
Wow.
I'm not raising my voice at all. To the impression you did of the Bellinger home run, kind of screaming your ass off.
Yeah.
You know, so you can find me everywhere in that spectrum and still, you know, you still try to work on it. And one of the things I still do is it's hard to go back and listen to a full game at this point. You know, life gets in the way and 162 games get in the way. But I still try to go back quickly after the game and at least listen to the highlights to see where, how I felt. How I felt, how that matched up to how it actually came off. So I felt like I was really punching it hard and doing it justice, and then I go back and listen, and maybe it fell flat.
Hmm.
I learned from that the next night, hopefully, and you know, kind of adjust that excitement level.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm wondering, too, you know, when you get out there, it seems like most broadcasters kind of gravitate toward there's a middle range, you know, that they can excited plus, excited minus, but they're in the excited range. And then you get to somebody like Gus Johnson, who's just that's how he makes his living. Is that really tough to pull off consistently? Do you need to be some like a unicorn type almost to be able to do that? Or like, does it not land well with everybody? Because when Gus does it, people legitimately love it.
It works.
But I'm not sure if it would work for everybody. And I don't even know what traits you would need to make it so that you're the guy who can do that and other people can't.
Yeah, and I think that can apply to a lot of things as a play-by-play guy, and really a lot of things in any industry. Trying to be something you're not is not going to work. It works for Gus because that's who Gus is, man. Mm-hmm. Gus loves getting up for those big moments, and you can tell that it's genuine and sincere. Whereas if I try to do what Gus does, it just sound like I was trying to be Gus. You know, it wouldn't sound like, wow, Joe's great at, you know, elevating these big moments by being super excited. It just sounded like I was trying to be somebody who's great at elevating by being extra excited. So I think you gotta be careful of, you know, once you find where you belong, not trying to steer away from it.
Hmm. Okay, so let's talk about this World Series and this playoff journey. And I think that what's interesting too is, you know, the last couple of years we've had cities that just have not experienced that success at the highest level.
Right.
Obviously the Cubs, Cleveland certainly, Houston never won anything, you know, so there's that. And in the Dodgers' case, this is five division titles in a row. This is a very successful franchise, but it doesn't have the playoff success. Jonah. So we're back in recording. That was a fire drill. And what's funny is, I'm talking to Joe Tuesday. So yesterday, basically, because it's coming out on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And I followed my story on Monday night. And I hesitate to use Monday night. It was Tuesday morning at 6:30 in the morning. So if this had gone on in the Houston hotel at whatever, or 10 a.m. or something like that, I would have murdered somebody. Yeah. That would have been a rough one. So we're talking about the city of L.A. and kind of the atmosphere for all this, because I feel like there's optimism, but I wonder if there's a little fatalism, too, that it's just, oh, well, we're going to get to the playoffs, and this is going to happen, and something bad is going to happen. What was the sense that you got coming into this year? Did it feel different? Did it feel like, well, this team is better than those teams, we can do this? Or was it, I don't know, like, it's been rough the last few years?
I think that there's definitely some of that, and you don't blame them, right? Yeah. It's like the boy who cried wolf kind of thing. Yeah. Four consecutive division titles, but, there's always the but. And I think that's okay. Like, the fans can and probably should have that attitude. It's been a long time since they've won here. So you've crossed that off getting back to the World Series, because it's been just as long since they've done that. Mm-hmm. If they don't win, though, you're still going to have some of that. I don't think fans are going to be satisfied and say, oh, you've won all these division titles. We got to the World Series, though, so we're back. No, it's a bottom line thing. Yeah. You know, they need to win the World Series for fans to get over some of that fatalism that's going on.
Well, and the thing that irks me the most, and I think that a lot of people around the Dodgers say the same thing, is the Kershaw narrative, which is the worst, because especially you being around the team, you would get to know Kershaw a little bit. I've gotten to know Kershaw a little bit. I've written about Kershaw many times, and like, nobody cares more about anything ever in the world than Clayton Kershaw cares about pitching. And he works his ass off, and all of a sudden he builds orphanages in Africa. And if you wanted to root for a human being to succeed, it would be Clayton Kershaw. Yeah. And great in his previous couple of postseason starts, and not so good in his last time out. How do you do that as an announcer trying to set the stage and provide context and all that? You know, with, you don't want to perpetuate this false narrative, but also if he's giving up bombs, he's giving up seven or eight this postseason, that's not so great.
Yeah, it's, you know, as a Dodger announcer, you try to put a positive spin on things Dodger-related. Now, if I'm doing the games for Fox, then it is what it is. I mean, he's been one of the greatest regular season pitchers we've ever seen. He's not been that guy in the postseason. With what happened in Game 5, it's hard even from a Dodger announcer perspective to spin it any other way than that. Now, and you mentioned how this is Tuesday currently in real life. People are going to be listening to this on Wednesday. I hope tonight, as in Wednesday night, is a Game 7.
Yes.
And that he has a chance to maybe come out of the bullpen and not totally change the postseason legacy, but at least shift it. Mm-hmm. Where the latest thing you're going to know about him is maybe something like Madison Bumgarner did in 2014, and can at least start to shift that narrative.
Yeah, it seemed like he was there almost. He gave 11 strikeouts and just magnificent. And, you know, well, let me ask you this. What do you make of this? Tom Verducci wrote a column about the slick baseball. Kershaw, in his most recent start, throws 39 sliders. By the way, the slider, side note, the story that I wrote for Grantland in 2013 talking about Kershaw. Yeah. Kershaw had never thrown a slider in his life, and he goes down to the bullpen with A.J. Ellis and Borzello, the bullpen coach, and throws it, and they all go, that's the best slider we've ever seen. Yeah. He'd never thrown a slider. He's Roy Hobbs. But he throws 39 sliders in his most recent start and one swinging strike. It didn't seem like he had command of the slider. The Gurriel home run was on a slider. You buying it?
It's hard not to at this point, right? Yeah. I mean, and when it's not just guys talking about it, it's what you're mentioning there. We're seeing it actually shown that this is different. You know, the results of the slider, like the pitch that people are talking about being effective, the results are completely different than you're used to seeing. I just don't know how can that happen, that the skin of the baseball is that different from what it's been previously? Like, how does that happen?
Poor Darvish, who's a real slider specialist, he got crushed.
I know.
Yeah. It's Verlander. I mean, it's not like it's coming from one team, too. Verlander has a very effective slider. He gave up a big hit on that one, too.
No. Yeah. I mean, it's not... everybody's using the same ball. but not everybody relies on the slider.
Correct.
Like Clayton Kershaw does, mm-hmm. like Kenta Maeda does,
yeah.
like Yu Darvish, and you know, he has a wide array of pitches he throws,
yeah.
but everybody's using the same ball, but not everybody's affected the same.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. When you're looking over this World Series, well, let's start with Game 1 with the Kershaw start.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a beauty, and Keuchel pitched well, too, and it was
yeah.
really well done. Do you have a preference? I mean, these games, some of these games, most of these games have been the 13-12 game, obviously, but that one was such a pitching gem. Do you go back and say, I'm a Koufax guy, or are you like, oh, I'm a Barry Bonds guy? Like, oh, I guess I'm asking a Dodger announcer that question. That's silly, but you know what I mean. Do you prefer that the slugfest just has so much wild action versus just kind of the old school, like, you know, for a game to take, was it 220 or two, something like
225, that? 225, 221.
But, yeah, I mean, does one work better for you than the other?
Yeah, I like the tidy,
yeah?
the tidy 2.5 hour game. Selfishly, as a broadcaster, it's hard to be really clean and in rhythm if the game drags.
Yeah.
So when that game has that great pace to it, guys are getting the ball and throwing it, quick outs are made. And I think there's also, might seem counterintuitive, but there's an added layer of drama and tension when it's not 13-12.
Yeah.
When you're wondering what one swing is going to do it. Whereas Jose Altuve hits a 3-run home run to tie the game in game 5, and there's still another 3 home runs coming. So I kind of like the, you know, the 2-1 pitcher's duel if I had to choose.
It's funny you say that about announcers. During game 5, it was the middle of the 10th, I think it was, and I'd gone for a bathroom break, and here comes Joe Buck to the urinal next to me, and the look on his face, man, we're like 5 hours in. You know, these home runs or whatever. It's just like,
yeah, yes.
It's amazing. And game 2, I mean, I thought game 2 would be, okay, that's the crazy game.
Right.
What, I mean,
game 5
yeah.
was game 2's extra innings for 10 innings.
That's right. That's
you
exactly
know?
What it was.
It was what happened that made game 2 special just the entire night.
Did game 2, how does that resonate for you? Because obviously the Dodgers didn't win, and you know, the home crowd's disappointed and so forth. When you're calling, let's say, an opponent's dramatic home run, mm-hmm. I think there are different approaches to that, too. You're not going to
sure.
be like, yay, but there has to be a little bit of voice modulation on that, too. Oh, well, Hawk, except for Hawk Harrell's going to be like, and it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, because
yeah,
that's Hawk.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you approach that?
Especially in this city.
Yeah.
Because of the legendary play-by-play announcers that have been in this city.
Yes.
Who were notoriously down the middle, even when they were doing a team.
Yeah.
Vin doing the Dodgers, Chick Hearn doing the Lakers, mm-hmm. Bob Miller doing the Kings. All these guys, of course, there was a bit of a tilt to it towards the team they were broadcasting, but they were very fair and very impartial by team announcer standards. So because that's the expectation here, I think that there is probably even somewhat of a conscious effort for me as a Dodger announcer still to give due diligence to the other side.
Yeah.
Because if I'm at all, you mentioned Hawk Harrelson, who it works for Hawk.
Absolutely it does.
Hawk.
You know what you're getting with Hawk.
If I'm doing that,
yeah.
that doesn't resonate well here because of the expectation that's been laid by the greatest ever to do it in the Dodger booth and a lot of the greatest ever to do it across sports here in the city.
So I want to get to the Scully legacy. Obviously, we have to talk about that. But that's very interesting about Miller and Hearn because
mm-hmm.
obviously they're legends. But I wouldn't have necessarily thought that would be something that a baseball announcer in L.A. would focus on. But it sounds like you're plugged into the local ethos. So aside from the balance of it, what did you take away? You didn't grow up in L.A., but
yeah.
you know, going back with Miller and Hearn, whether it's listening to tapes or whether it's secondhand or whatever it is, what lessons can you learn from those two guys, aside from Scully?
Yeah, I think it's a similar thing
mm-hmm.
where it's they were, number one, they're revered for their longevity.
Yes.
It shows that.
Well, you're starting young, so that's good. And
yeah,
you're going to the gym, so hopefully this is good.
Come on,
yeah.
keep doing overhead press.
Yeah,
I got no shot.
Okay.
yeah, I think that the longevity is not a mistake. I think that it's, in this city, I think the fan base has shown that it's going to wrap its arms around its announcers if you are doing it fairly for both sides. There's something in common with all these guys. Yeah, they're great storytellers. Yeah, they rise to the moment. But they're not cheating the listeners.
Mm.
You know, they're not going to... If Yasiel Puig dogs a ball, if Jock Peterson dogs a ball. These guys are going to tell you.
Yeah.
They may not beat it over the head, but they're going to tell you what happens regardless of who's doing it, regardless of if it's good or bad for the team that they're covering. So I think that's, fundamentally speaking, what can be learned from all of those guys.
Life insurance. It's a pain in the butt. I've had to do it. It's not fun. You have to go through a million different companies and comparison shop, and it's too expensive, and it takes too long, and bleh, I don't like it. But you have to do it. Listen, especially if you have kids, which I do, you got to take care of it. Shopping for life insurance, it is confusing. It does take forever, but it doesn't with Policy Genius. Policy Genius lets you compare life insurance from the top providers online. It can take as little as 5-10 minutes. You can get it done. You want to find a policy that you like, you want to know more, you could talk to one of their licensed experts, or you could just browse and do it yourself online, whatever you want. And not just life insurance, they have disability insurance, renter's insurance, pet insurance, health insurance. Whatever you need, they've got it, and they're great. So if you need life insurance and you've been putting it off, try Policy Genius. You can compare life insurance online on your own terms in your own time. It's policygenius.com. PolicyGenius.com. Because you should only be forced to speak to an agent if you've committed a federal crime. Okay, so how does one replace Vin Scully?
Yeah.
So let's start with this. Did you ask him? Did you, the first time you met him, was it just, sir, it's an honor to meet you? Or was it like, let me try to learn some lessons from this guy? How did you approach that?
Yeah, so the first time I met him was the night before my hiring was announced. I was still in Michigan at this point, and he called me, and I didn't have his number, so I ignored the call twice. I ignored two of Vince Scully's calls, right? Yeah. But the nice part about that was I got a voicemail out of it from Vince Scully.
Which I would keep until my death and make that my outgoing voicemail message and
right?
all that stuff. Yeah.
Side note on that, I thought the same thing. Like, gosh, I wish there was a way to put this on a shelf or something. This is like my most treasured thing. My birthday was a few weeks later, and I opened up a gift from my wife, and it was a teddy bear with a Dodgers shirt. And I was like, oh, you know, cool. My wife got me a teddy bear. What the heck?
Yeah.
28 years old now. She said, I didn't get you a teddy bear, just a teddy bear. Squeeze it. And so I squeezed the teddy bear, and it played the voice.
Oh, that's so cool.
How great of a gift is that?
Wow.
So anyways, we finally hooked up that night over the phone, and it was a pretty brief conversation, him just welcoming me to the team. And,
yeah.
But we have had a couple of conversations where I've picked his brain about the job and how to do the job, period, and how to do the job in this city.
Mm-hmm.
Vin is, and I'm sure you know this, he's humble to the point where, like, he doesn't think that he's someone who should be sharing advice.
Yes.
He's uncomfortable telling you how to do the job. So that's a little tricky in that I want to soak up every little ounce of info I can get from Vin. But he doesn't really want to give it because he doesn't look at himself as that guy.
And it's not an act. It's not just like conscious self-deprecation. He just literally doesn't think that he's special.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is part of what makes him special.
Yes.
Right? His biggest thing to me is to be myself.
Yeah.
And that's the same advice Red Barber gave to him when he, you know,
Two steps from Red Barber.
Secondhand advice from Red Barber. Believe me, I've thought about that many times.
I think before Red Barber would actually be, you know, like Moses or something. Like, that's what I feel a lineage is.
Yeah, when Moses took over the Brooklyn
took
booth.
The Ten Commandments, gave it to Red Barber.
Yeah. But it, especially in a baseball season, 162 games, if you're anything other than yourself, you're going to get exposed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the biggest thing. And it seems like a simple thing, just be you, but it's not. Especially not when you're following Red Barber, who at the time people could probably say to Vin, hey, big shoes to fill here. Red Barber's the greatest ever to do this.
Sure.
That's not far-fetched. He didn't have the longevity Vin had, but it's a similar line of thinking to the situation that I found myself in, following the greatest ever to do the job.
Yeah.
The tendency, I think, in that situation, if you don't protect against it consciously, is to try and be the person that so perfectly has done the job for 67 years and has been the only voice that this city's known since the team relocated. I think the tendency would be to just try and be that guy. But me trying to be Vin Scully is going to be that. Me trying to be Vin Scully and falling flat on my face. So taking that simple advice and allowing myself to be myself, that was Vin's biggest thing to me.
talking about doing Fox games, and there's a tendency among baseball fans, I think, to be annoyed when there's a when the national broadcast is on, because that guy doesn't know my team the way that other people do. That, and it is, you know, if I'm listening, if I'm watching a Mets game or whatever, I mean, I don't know how many people do it better than that three-man booth or whatever. Yeah. And even if you look at somebody like Darling, who goes into a national broadcast, he doesn't do it the same way. He doesn't have, he can't, it's impossible. Sure. He doesn't have banter. He doesn't know them as well. Darling was on Nationals games. He was kind of going after Harper, those guys a little bit. And it was, I loved it, because I'm like, yeah, be petty. It's amazing. But, you know, Nationals fans were like, what's going on, man? Like, I didn't ask for this. You know, from your perspective, if it's a if you're calling a Fox game and it's not a Dodger game, are you just on full court press to try to get to the point where you have something close to the knowledge that the local guys have?
Yeah.
Do you have notes in your ear from the broadcasters? Speak in broader terms so that people who are not big baseball fans will understand, because it, by definition, it doesn't seem like they're as hardcore if you're talking on a national broadcast.
Yeah, it's, and especially in the social media age,
yes,
it's, right or not, it's made us a whole other level of accountable.
Yes.
Like you, it probably shouldn't, like, you shouldn't worry about that, but we're all human, mm-hmm. right? You don't like to open up your Twitter feed and see that you screwed something up about these guys' local team. So, yeah, you do have to. When I could, so I did Astros Red Sox for Fox and ALDS, and I tried to. It's not going to happen, but you try to put yourself in a spot where, with a few days of preparation, you can not teach, but at least talk to the fan who looks at their fandom like it's a full time job.
Yeah.
You can at least have a conversation with those people about their team. So yeah, I talk to broadcasters from the teams that I'm covering. I try to get the general storylines of the season. You dive in a little bit deeper in your reading about each player. But you don't try. I think it's really important too, and I had a great conversation with Joe Buck before I did this series. It was my first postseason series. He's done a few of them. And so I picked his brain about, you know, how to handle that. And his thing is, one of his things was, don't try to prove to them that you know their
team. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? So get to the point where you feel like you do. But it ain't going to work if you try to prove to them that you know, because there's going to be a little detail off that where they're going to say, this guy's an idiot. Even if it's one little thing. And I can relate, because being the Dodger guy, if I see an outsider come in and try to talk about it, and this is not saying anything about any national broadcaster, but when you're in it every day, you know the details down to the very finest detail. So yeah, it's just something where you know it, but you don't try to prove that you know it when you get on that, when you get into that neutral national stage.
I want to talk about Puig.
I love talking about Puig.
I love talking about Puig too. And I want to start with this. If I didn't already love Puig, Scully legitimized the phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
Puig wasn't a distraction. He wasn't too much. He wasn't any of that. He was the wild horse. And the wild horse is the exact right term, because wild horses, there's a lovely song written about wild horses. It's a great song. In fact, it's done by more than one artist that I enjoy. And there's a certain evocative nature to saying that, where it's wild horses are beautiful, wild horses are unpredictable, wild horses are, and it's just, it's, yes, that's exactly right. And he had that the right way. When you were coming into this job, did you, well, I guess it's, maybe it's a general question too, but specifically about Puig, did you go back and watch old Scully stuff? Did the wild horse thing resonate with you? Did you try to sink your teeth into all that? Obviously you have to form your own impressions, but I think it would be relevant, you know, especially in his rookie season, which was just like a phenomenon, to have absorbed some of that. So I'm wondering how you went about that.
Yeah, I can't say that I went back and tried to listen to how Vin painted it. I had never even really thought about the fact that him putting that nickname on him helped kind of define him.
Yeah.
And helped his act, for lack of a better word, be acceptable when he's performing.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Yes.
You know, when you perform, you get a better chance of being tolerable. But I think it doesn't take long when you're watching Yasiel Puig play to have that be the opinion. Like, if you give him a chance, you know, if you're not going into it saying, oh, this guy's act is BS, I'm not going to put up with this. If you don't have those preconceived notions, how can you not watch him and see the joy that he plays with and love it? You know, So for me, I didn't need to go back and listen to the way Vin painted him to kind of have that same impression.
Hmm. You know, what was interesting about Puig too, I think the thing that's resonated most of, let's say, these playoffs was not a Puig play. Bellinger, it was the 9th or 10th, it was late, and I guess it was game 5. I can't even keep track. Each of these games is like Homer's Odyssey. And Bellinger goes over to the stands and puts his knee on the barrier and snacks the ball.
Yeah, Sunday night, game 5.
Game 5. And Puig comes over to him. Yes! Yeah, taps his glove. Yeah! Like, what a play that was! And that was Puig. You know, wasn't it licking the bat? And all that stuff is great, but it was just like, yes. Yeah, I'm so freaking fired up, and we're in this game, and wow, and we tied it up, and it's 12-12, and just, that's what resonated for me. That's being a good teammate, I think, to do that. I would think so. Yeah. I don't, he just strikes me as having enthusiasm all the time, which I think most people don't have. They have down switches, and he doesn't seem to have a down switch. Maybe that's what gets people, I don't know about irked, but kind of thrown off kilter. Like, no, most people kind of have rhythms. This guy's at 100 all the time.
Right. And, I mean, there are two other things, too.
Yeah.
He's still young.
Yes.
Right? 26 years old.
Yeah.
And he's not been in this culture for that long.
Correct.
80% of his life was in a different world that none of us can wrap our minds around, and especially the baseball culture in that world in Cuba.
Yeah.
So he's still pretty new to the culture that says you have to have that off switch now and then. I'm not sure he's ever going to be someone who cares to understand that. And I think that's okay. I don't know. I mean, there are always going to be those people who, the get off my lawn types, where he's never going to be somebody they like, but hopefully on this World Series stage, there's a large bit of the population that's now getting to see him play with that joy that he plays with, and I think it's good for baseball. Hopefully the country's thinking the same thing watching him.
I don't know how much of this is an open secret or not, but like, it's not been easy for him. The defection did not go smoothly. I mean, I don't know how far down the road we're supposed to go on this. People in baseball kind of know this stuff, but he owes people money, I think. Or they claim that he owes them money, things of that nature. I feel like you can go one of two ways there. You can be terrified and you live your life in a shell, or you could be like, this is my refuge from these serious problems that most of us do not have and will never have.
Yeah. And, I mean, I don't know the details of that stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, it's kind of ambiguous, but whatever.
Right. I know enough to know that it was not simple.
Correct.
Getting over here, and I don't think it's completely settled.
That's a good way to put it.
I don't know that it ever is for those guys
to
risk what they do to come over from Cuba. So, yeah, and maybe the joy that he plays with, and maybe that is like an expression of this being a refuge from what is much more real life outside of the ballpark. And that's speculation, but that would make sense.
I would think so. And the culture thing, too, is interesting because I think it kind of invites the question of, what's the culture? Who says this is the culture? You know, at this point, the game is about 1/3 Latin-born. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we're dealing with. And I went to the WBC this year in L.A., went to the finals. And I'd been to WBC game a few years before. And I just have this thing, this is a personal bias, but I've never been big on exhibitions. I've never been big on things that, like, or even the Olympics. I'm just not an Olympic guy. I'd rather see, you know, the Dream Team or whatever. I'd rather see the Lakers play the Clippers or whatever. I'm like that. I don't know why. Maybe I mean, pro is the highest level, therefore I'm a pro guy.
Yeah.
But I'm watching these games. I'm watching Javi Baez. I'm watching all these dudes. Team Colombia. I'm just like, this is the most fun ever. The fans are crazy into it. And each time, not a walk-off. If there's an RBI single, 20 guys jump out of the dugout.
Yes.
And it's so fun.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it was decided that the culture of Major League Baseball is not that, because that seems to be objectively more fun. And I guess I'm wondering, at what point can the culture not be white? At what point can the culture not be what it was in Major League Baseball? Will there be a shift, and what would it take to get to that shift?
I think we're seeing it.
Yeah?
Like, I just think back to, and again, I don't know what game it was within this World Series, but where, because it all runs together.
I know.
Like a weird dream. I guess it was game 2. Correa's bat flip.
Yes.
Epic.
2, yeah.
And then the next inning, Puig almost like tips his cap to him by just laying the bat down. That's a blast.
It was so fun.
Why does baseball's culture need to suppress that? What harm does that do? Especially when, okay, if you're going to argue, well, it shows up the pitcher. Listen to the pitchers after the game talk about those moments. Somebody asks, who gave up the home run? Josh Fields, I guess. Kenley Jansen gave up a home run to Gonzalez that night. Somebody asked him about the reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kenley's quote was, if he hits a home run off me, he can do that. Oral Hershiser, my partner, who pitched in an era that was even more get off my lawn, talks about guys when they hit home runs. If they hit them, they earned it. They can do what they want. And I think that hopefully we're seeing the game, as we're seeing so many things within the game shift, this season in particular, I hope that we're seeing that, where it becomes more and more acceptable to express yourself and enjoy and appreciate yourself when you do something well. I think the WBC was a great example of what it can look like if we allow that.
And by the way, I grew up with Pascual Perez, the most animated pitcher who ever, maybe one of the most anyway. And then you've got guys like Jason Grilli. You know, it's a 3-run game. He gets a couple guys out in the eighth, and he's like, yes, yes, yeah, you know, like that. So why is it okay for pitchers but not hitters? This imbalance always got to me. So, yeah, I would hope that we get to that point. I love the Puig quote, too. They asked Puig after the game about the Correa flip, and he said it was fantastic. Like, he was crazy. He just said, that's exactly what you're supposed to do, even though he laid the bat down or whatever. And I just thought, well, yeah, and maybe we are at that tipping point that it gets to that stage, because I think that, you know, as fans, we want to be emotionally invested. Game 5 was just, and it doesn't matter if anybody flipped their bat. It was incredible what happened. But we want this stuff to be fun. And I guess it kind of leads into my next thing, which is, you know, Rob Manfred is talking about ways to speed up the game. And I actually have come around a little bit on the pitch clock. I think that I can understand it, just working on things like that. And the general effort here is to try to make people more engaged in baseball, to try to win more young fans and so forth. Is it changing the culture? Is it speeding up the game? Is it something else? Because right now the game seems to be regional. I'm a big Angels fan, but I'm not that big a big MLB fan. Whereas in basketball, it's like, oh, Curry, LeBron, I'll watch anything.
I love the NBA.
So, I don't know. What might it take to get to the point where it's more embraced? Because it doesn't seem like, you know, if you're 10 years old and not white in America, I don't know how likely you are to be a baseball fan right now or to become a baseball fan.
I think part of it is, and I think this is shifting as well, but part of it is, I don't know that baseball's biggest stars, it's not that they aren't marketable.
Yeah.
Maybe it has been that they're not. Like, Mike Trout's a pretty boring character.
He is. Yeah.
And that's okay. That's who Mike Trout is.
Yeah.
But it's not okay when you're talking about the marketability to young fans. That's why I think this World Series is so healthy for the game, and for that reason. You're seeing some of baseball's more gregarious stars, like Correa, like Puig is, I think you can call him a star with the total package
of
what he's doing. Altuve. Yeah. Right. These are recognizable personalities and that I think younger fans can latch on to.
Yeah.
I don't know that a younger fan's going to latch on to a game because it's 2.5 hours versus 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's more, who can they identify with? The kids are not wrapping their minds around the fact that the game is faster. I think it's not going to hurt if they speed the game up.
Yeah.
You know, over the course of a long season. But I don't think because a game is 15 minutes shorter, whatever, on average, is going to lead to more kids watching the games more consistently. I think it's these young stars becoming bigger and bigger stars.
Hey, look who's sponsoring the podcast this week. It's our friends at Blue Apron. Love Blue Apron. They're the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They achieve this with a sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. And I've used Blue Apron. Let me tell you something, friends. I am a bad cook. I struggle. It's a challenge. Blue Apron makes it easy. They basically send you a big box, and it's got everything in there. So you've got prepackaged whatever it is, your protein, your starch, your spices, all that stuff, exactly portioned. They make the instructions really easy to use. From the time you take everything out of the box to the time it's on your plate, 45 minutes to an hour, and it's fun. You know, it's not too difficult. Everything is there for you. You get it done. You get all the stuff done. You got kids, you can cook with your kids. You got a partner, you can cook with your partner. Whatever it is you could possibly want, they are fantastic. Really, really great. And get this, upcoming meal: summer vegetable and egg paninis with Calabrian chili mayonnaise and caprese salad, soy glazed pork and rice cakes with bok choy and marinated green beans, skillet vegetable chili with cornmeal and cheddar drop biscuits. Wow. And garlic, butter, shrimp, and corn with green bean salad and roasted purple tomatoes. It's great. They offer stuff that you wouldn't necessarily cook yourself or think to cook yourself, but it's really, really great. Check out this week's menu and you can get your first three meals free, that's right, free, with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Jonah, J-O-N-A-H, but you should know that. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Jonah, Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Jonah. Yeah, I'm still thinking about game five. You know what it was? When the Dodgers came up in the ninth, I knew they were going to tie the game.
Mm-hmm.
I've never felt anything more certainly. But I didn't think that they were going to take the lead because I thought it would go to extra innings. I thought that somehow they would land on three runs, and I didn't know how. And then Puig comes up, and I'm doing it. Okay, that's a two-run home run. It's not going to happen. And then, like, the wild pitch. And then Taylor comes up. I'm like, oh, Taylor's. And Taylor, oh, yeah. Taylor's the peskiest hitter. And
basically,
he's like new Ben Zobrist. I'm such a big Chris Taylor fan.
Me too.
And I'm just like, oh yeah, that's a single. I think I might have written it in my scorebook by then or whatever. Yeah. It was just, I don't even have a question, but it was just this phenomenon, this game that I was just like, have you ever read the Iowa Baseball Confederacy?
No.
It's a book by a guy named W.P. Kinsella who wrote Shoeless Joe, Field of Dreams. And Kinsella, my favorite author. You should read it, and I'll give it to you, I'll send it to you. The premise of it is that this guy goes into a wormhole and there's a baseball game that lasts more than 2,000 innings. And it's just, it's mystical and magical and it's wonderful. And, I thought we were in the Iowa Baseball Confederacy. And the game, even in nine innings, I was like, yeah, this feels like 2,000 innings, but in the best possible way. You don't usually get that phenomenon where it's such a long game, but it's so deliriously joyful. It didn't matter how long it was. It almost mattered in a good way that it was long because it just, it kept going and it kept going. Can you sit back and just be joyful that this stuff is happening when you're calling a game? Or do you have to go, okay, well, it's time for this and it's time for me to read my sponsor read?
I mean, that game was so unique.
Yeah.
Like that one in particular, and the fact that in the postseason broadcasts, I'm not calling these. I don't know what that would have been like for me to call.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that I can compare that game five to any game I've ever actually called.
Not unless you called the David Freeze game.
Which I didn't.
That's what, and by that, win for me. Win probability added, the David Freeze game was the number one World Series game of all time. This is number two in terms of swings.
Okay, that's
what makes sense. It's about right. More than Joe Carter, more than Carlton Fisk, more than any of those other games.
Yeah, that for me, that David Freeze game was, that's, if I overcompensate for recency bias, that's one where my mind immediately goes to, and at least for people of my generation, that's got to be number one, you know, win probability.
For sure.
Or not.
You talked about Joe Buck. I did a podcast with him in the World Series last year, and it's the weirdest split because everybody in the industry is like, you know, Joe Buck is the industry standard, and he's really good and really this and really that. I don't know what it is that gets people that way. Maybe it's perceived bias about the Cardinals, or maybe it's this or that or whatever, something that happened 10 years ago. I don't even think that he's the same broadcaster now than he was 10 years ago. What do you make, maybe not so much about Buck, but what do you make about that when an announcer doesn't really hit people right? Like, why, what do you think it is? Is it just literally that national, local thing, or is there something else going on? Well, forget about Buck, whether it's anybody who gets backlash, what might lead to that kind of backlash?
Yeah, but I think it's appropriate to ask the question about Joe and particular, because, and I think what it is, and I've thought about it a lot, because he's the guy that I grew up wanting
of course.
Be, you know, for... He's called all the biggest games that I can remember.
In football, too.
Yes. Yeah. So for as long as I can remember as a sports fan, he was the guy. Not just a sports fan, but a sports fan wanting to do what he's doing one day.
Yeah.
You know, as a young kid. It's him calling those biggest games has aligned with the advent of social media.
Yeah.
And I think it's become the popular thing to do on there, even if you don't know what you're talking about, to dislike him.
Yeah.
And it's the popular thing to say that he hates my team. You know, and I get it a bunch from Dodger fans on Twitter. Why does Joe Buck hate us? And like, I'm not going to fire back at people on this.
Yeah.
But it's just so ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, it's so unfair to him, who is, you know, in my generation, the greatest to do this nationally. Yeah. I don't even know how many, the percentage of people that get mad that he hates their team, I would think the percentage of that group is less than 50 that actually know that he has a background with the Cardinals.
Hmm. Yeah, especially the younger folks, maybe. Yeah, you're right.
So It's just, it's become, it's like snowballed, it seems like, to where it's popular to dislike Joe, even though there's nobody better.
So I want to talk a little bit about the path, and we talked about Joe Block before, man. Joe hustled. He beat the Bushes. He broke in. His first major league game was with the Expos, which still tickles me. It's delightful. Represent.
Yeah, and the Expo socks on.
I got the Expo socks on. And, but I want to ask you about how you went about it. You said that you were already calling games while you were in college, that you would go and just do a summer's worth of games, which is incredible and unpaid, but you made it happen and were getting reps early. I would assume that's one of the best ways that you could do any job is, right, is just,
Do it.
I'm 12, I'm going to jump on them. 18, I'm gonna, however earliest you can, you do it.
So I played football in college,
yeah.
But the recruiting pitch from the coach was that I could announce the basketball games right away. So, yeah.
Were you a journalism major?
Communications, yeah. But not at a broadcasting school. In fact, at Beloit College in Wisconsin where I went, they split the freshmen up into, your freshmen come a couple weeks early and you get split up into these groups, I don't remember what they're called or whatever, we have an advisor. My advisor was a physics professor who was also a world-class trumpet player. Perfect kind of advisor to have for a play-by-play guy, right?
Yeah.
I remember sitting down with him my first week on campus and going over career plans, and I told him what I wanted to do, and he looked at me and said, "What is a play-by-play broadcaster?" Oh, shit. Maybe I should have went to Syracuse. But the benefit of that was... Exactly.
Northwestern, yeah.
The benefit was I didn't have to compete with anybody to get whatever reps there were.
Yeah.
So I kind of had the monopoly on calling games there and had a village of people that were willing to help me create opportunities to get hands-on experience.
Mm.
And that is everything, especially in a job like this. It's a very specific skill, just going out and doing it.
Yeah. You talked about the randomness of it, and we were talking about my guy growing up, which was Dave Van Horn, who called the Expos games and still a radio broadcaster for the Marlins. I think he's in his 80s now, so that's pretty good. And he talked about, they pulled the tape off the top of a pile of 300 people or whatever. Did you have one of those random experiences? I feel like so much of it is skill and hard work, and there has to be some luck involved. Do you remember what your luckiest stroke was, other than the fact that I guess you have now replaced Vin Scully? That's pretty lucky. but I mean, in terms of just like randomness.
Yeah, it happens a lot. I mean, there's a story that's been told a couple times about me writing a letter to Len Casper.
Mm-hmm. Who's wonderful, sure the is, best. Man. Such a good guy, too.
So lucky to have him in my corner, yeah.
Yeah.
Wrote him a letter while I was in college, going to a Cubs game with my dad, dropped the letter on the way to the stadium. Owner of the Taco Bell across the street found it, called me later that day, said they'd give it to Len, got it to Len.
The Taco Bell!
Taco Bell, yeah. Len wound up being somebody who, when I got my first job in Montgomery, Alabama, was my reference that called when I was a finalist.
Jeez.
Still one of my...
Pretty good.
One of my... greatest mentors, and I consider him a great mentor and a great friend now. So that's luck that letter found him.
Yeah.
When I was in Montgomery, my first minor league job, Montgomery Biscuits, Tampa Bay Rays, AA affiliate. Yep. One of my first games, I got an email from a guy. You get, there were 100 listeners and 10 of them would email each night in the minors, right? And this guy sent a nice email the first night that he was tuned in from Connecticut. Emailed me again a week later, and it was like a critique of my first week. And I'm like, well, who the hell is this? Right? What are we doing here? I thought you were a fan listening. And I got down to the bottom of the email, and it said ESPN Communications. And I'm like, are you kidding me? What is going on here?
Amazing.
Turns out this guy, and he wasn't anybody who like could hire anybody at ESPN. He worked in PR there, and he had hurt he blew out his Achilles playing pickup soccer or something, and so was on injured leave from work, and read about the Biscuits, logged onto the website to buy a hat, clicked on the Listen Live link, decided to stick with it, and liked what he heard, became a Biscuits fan.
Is that the Desmond Jennings era?
This was right after Desmond Jennings, so this was Matt Moore, Chris Archer.
That's pretty good.
Matt Moore, Chris Archer, Alex Cobb, Jake McGee.
Holy cow!
Oh, it was
that's
something.
As good as it gets. Yeah,
Adam Liberatore, Alex Torres. We had quite the pitch in there, but we kind of became friends, this guy and I. And the next year, just in passing, he asked me if he could help me book any guests for my pregame show, and it's like, I don't. really need that, but could you introduce me to somebody at ESPNU?
Sure.
And so he sent an email or two and got me hooked up with some people there. And I don't want to say got me out of Montgomery, but the thing that caused me to leave the biscuit job was I signed a 2-year contract with ESPN through relationships that, I guess the genesis of them were this random ass luck that this guy tuned in.
And you're like 22, 3?
I was 24 when 24. I signed with ESPN.
Wow.
21 when I took the biscuits job.
Wow. Yeah, that's, pickup soccer. It's amazing. What did you order at Taco Bell that day?
I didn't actually even go to Taco Bell. I just happened to drop the letter in front of it.
Oh, my God.
Good thing I didn't drop in front of McDonald's. Who knows what they would have done there.
You should have ordered a Gordita Crunch or something. You got to make that happen.
Yeah.
And so, what do you remember the day that you got the call from the Dodgers? I'm sure you do. What was the reaction? Did you feel like, okay, I'm a front runner? Like, how did they telegraph it for you? And finally the realization, oh, yeah, I'm replacing Vin Scully, no big. Yeah.
It was a weird, kind of a weird process, not your traditional, oh, there's an opening, oh, they like you, oh, you're a finalist. It didn't have that traditional arc to it, I guess, because this hasn't happened too many times where the greatest ever to do it stepped away.
One time, Red Barber.
Yeah, right. Fall of 2014?
Mm-hmm.
Fall 2014, I think, yeah. My agent called and said, hey, do you have an updated baseball tape? The Dodgers are starting to talk about what life will look like once Vin decides to hang it up. And I sent it over and thought, wow, yeah. And at that point, I was like, I don't even know if I would want that, if that would work. You know, I'm doing this great package with Fox. And
yeah.
I don't know that it would line up. A few months later, I was in L.A. for a Fox meeting and decided to swing by the stadium to meet some of the people that we had been in contact with and didn't know how significant the interest was, other than it was cool that they knew who I was. Well, I sit down in that meeting, and they tell me that I'm one of 3 or 4 people they're considering. I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah.
So this is, maybe I need to really start thinking about this. And I remember them saying, if you're interested, and, you know, your answer is, yes, I'm always interested, and yes, I know how to do this, and then you can always retract it moving forward. But my initial thought was, I think I am, but still, like, I'm in a good spot with Fox.
Hmm.
So I call my wife, and I said, honey, this is like a real thing here. You know, they're very interested. This was February of 2015. Several months go by, and, I don't think this is, like, private anymore. Brian Anderson and Matt Vaskirjian were guys that they were very
excellent.
Yeah. They were very interested in. Ultimately, it wasn't the right fit for those guys.
Yeah.
And my agent was in town in Grand Rapids, where I was living in Michigan, just for a little couple-day golf trip. And we were headed to... My wife was driving us. We had a few too many Oberons on the golf course that day.
So can never have too many.
That's right. We were driving to dinner.
Pure Michigan.
That's yes, Jonah.
Bells too, right? Bells, uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, man. Respect. Yeah. I mean, you're a Denver guy. You can respect.
I've crafted a few crafts, yes. Yeah.
And Josh, my agent, gets a call from another agent back in the office in New York and said, hey, call Lon Rosen at the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And we had been talking on the golf course that day, like, wow, you think it could really happen? Like, it would be awesome if it did. And we get to dinner, and Josh, my wife and I go to get us a table, and Josh is out in the parking lot talking on the phone, and he comes in, and he's like, we got a table yet? I'm like, are you kidding me, dude? Like, what's going on? And they wanted to hire me.
Oh, my God.
So it was several times out of the blue, all at the same time, knowing... It was like I knew that it was real and that I had a really good shot, but that didn't add up. There was no way that it was too good to be true that I even had a shot, and then it kind of smacked me in the face that they wanted to hire me. That was June 2015, and there were several months between then and the point where we actually figured it all out, because I didn't want to stop doing the national stuff, and I lucked out that both sides agreed to make it happen.
And so when you were doing... You come in 2016, mm-hmm. Vin's still there, so there's a transition period.
Yeah.
And obviously you know you have the job, so it's fine long term or whatever. Would you have rather jumped in with both feet, or was it okay, you know, like, let's do this transition period and whatever, and Vin's there, and let me figure it out, let me get my feet wet. Not that you weren't an inexperienced broadcaster at that point by any means.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a different kind of experience. Usually it's, okay, retirement year's end, cool, we have a new guy. Yeah. Here it's, okay, we're going to blend him into the mix.
I think it was perfect.
Yeah?
Both for me and, more importantly, for the fans.
Okay.
Where it wasn't as jarring, because it's going to be jarring no matter what when Vin is gone and the new guy's there.
67 years.
And right, every year the team has been here.
It's yes.
The only announcer they've ever known.
Yes.
So to kind of ease in and at least have some people get a taste of me for 1 year, I think that it was big for the fans, hopefully, to not have it be as jarring when I stepped into a full-time role, and good for me, too, to ease in for those same reasons.
What was the fan reaction? Whether it's social media, whether it's email, whether it's coming up to you in the ballpark, what did you get? I'm assuming it's going to be mostly positive, but yeah. I imagine that it can't be 100%, or maybe no, it's
of course not.
I'm going to miss Vin or whatever. How did that go for you?
I prepared myself for the worst.
Really?
I did. Yeah. I mean, again, this is kind of an unprecedented thing because of what Vin is.
Yes.
So I knew and would be able to understand if people weren't okay with me, but I've been blown away.
Nice.
With how kind they've been. It says more about them than it does about anything I've done. But they've made, from day one, me feel very welcome.
Mm-hmm.
I never sat in that chair and thought, I don't belong here. And that's largely because of the way people have welcome me and my family with open arms. And of course you're still going to have the people that say you're not Vin, and I always quickly say, you know, I'm happy to say you're damn right. I'm,
yeah, you're right.
Nobody is. And you're always going to have people that where it's a very subjective thing. I'm just not their style. Mm-hmm. That's fine too. But thankfully that feels like a really small portion of people, and it's probably a much bigger portion than I realize, but a very small portion of people who felt the need to voice that with me.
It's all exciting. I have one question, which I do at the end of every podcast, is I always ask the guest for a life tip, for a nugget of wisdom, for something that is their thing. If I meet you at a bar, I say, I'm Jonah, and this is what I'm about, and you say, I'm Joe, and this is what I'm about, and it can be a major philosophical breakthrough, or it can be like, oh yeah, when I wear loafers, I don't wear socks. Whatever you got, whatever is a okay. Just like, you know, your friends are describing, your family's describing, you're like, oh, that's Joe. Like, this is what you need to know about Joe.
Okay, yeah, we actually have a sign in our house that says work hard and be nice.
Nice.
And yeah, I found that sign after I'd kind of embraced that as, and that's not anything fancy or profound, but and it applies in any job and anything you do. It helps to not suck, right? You need
yes.
to be okay with what you do. But that's like one third of the equation. You got to work your tail off, and I think actually I'm not good at math, but those two parts are smaller. The be nice part—it's such a simple thing, and it's easy to overlook when we get so caught up in the working hard part
right.
and the being good at what you do part. But the being nice part—it doesn't take much work, and it's a really important part of success.
Yes.
I think. And you're not being nice to be successful.
That's it. It's an intrinsic good.
Yeah.
But it lets you get away if you biffed something.
Yes.
Well, that guy's not a dick. That's fine. I
yes.
don't care. Like, it's 100% pragmatically true.
And there are examples of it going the wrong way.
Yes.
In this business and in any industry where you don't get the benefit of that.
Barry Bonds is not in the Hall of Fame because he wasn't nice to the media.
There
it has nothing
go.
To do with steroids.
There
Other guys did steroids. Or allegedly, whatever.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's it.
Yeah. So,
well, and I don't care because I love Barry Bonds anyway, but that's
no,
what happened with other
example.
People. Yeah.
Work hard and be nice. And I mean, it sounds too flowery, but I think if we all kind of embrace that, then it's going to be a pretty cool place to live, this world.
Flowery's good. I like flowers.
Yeah. Well, work hard and be nice then.
That's good. Joe, this has been an absolute pleasure. You came
like
to my hotel room.
Likewise.
We had a fire drill. We connected a lot for
yeah,
a first-time meeting.
Did.
And I wish you all the best of success. And we're going to get to game 6 at the stadium and maybe a game 7. This could, I mean, we don't know after last year, but there is a chance that this could end up being the best World Series
wow.
ever played. Ever. It
wow.
is possible.
Yeah.
If we get two more epics, I would say it's the best World Series
you
ever.
You think
played.
So?
Because of 5-2.
Uh-huh.
And the swings of it, the two teams being, inherently two World Series teams are always good. 205 wins between the two teams. I think that historically, and I'm a big history guy,
mm-hmm.
I think you can make the case. It's got to be a big 6 and a big 7. If
uh-huh.
that happens, I think we're there.
And also, I think the and it's been well written about by several people, but kind of how it's representing where baseball is at so perfectly, right? I mean, you have, obviously the games are amazing, but it's just such a wonderful example of what the game is now. Some people may not use wonderful as the word, but it's just so perfectly baseball in 2017.
Home runs and strikeouts.
Yeah, and I don't know if that should contribute to it being the greatest World Series ever, but there's just so many little things to it that I agree with you, kind of set it apart. Maybe Game 7 finishes with something epic like a four-inning outing, if we get to a Game 7, a four-inning outing from Clayton Kershaw, something like that.
I have a feeling that if we get to a Game 7, it's going to be Chris Taylor at the plate in the 17th inning, and it's going to be 512 pitches. He's just that guy's going to grind you. They're going to have to make pitching changes during the at-bat. God, I love Chris Taylor.
That's such a Chris Taylor. I love baseball.
Baseball's fantastic.
That's good stuff.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Jonathan.